So we're going to start turning towards Tonglen a bit more. And well, yesterday I think some things that were being mentioned were and at other times as well, people can get quite overwhelmed with their experience, or think they've got to become some special compassionate person and kind of drum up some sort of big response. Yes. And some people mentioned being terrified and nervous about getting involved with this practice and what it was going to do to them. And I think we just need to have a much bigger container in how we engage with this practice, and a much stronger sense of spaciousness and of being resourced. And I think once that's in place, actually, everything else just naturally kind of follows. It'll all take care of itself. I think we can get into a lot of near and far enemies around compassion and activity. Engagement can become just another ego project that we're doing, and then it's just the same old, isn't it, really? Yes, we can also get into kind of slightly elevated ideas about who we are and what we have to offer. We can also get into slightly elevated ideas about what we aren't and what we don't have to offer. Think we can also get into a slightly patronizing relationship with other people. I think I can help. Whatever. I think another aspect, or another kind of near enemy, is a slightly self-sacrificing martyrdom sort of approach to everything. Yes, where you're kind of quite willing to do things or quite willing to engage, but there's strings attached, and eventually the strings get quite tight. Yeah, so we need a platform from which to step out from. And this is us, in a way, trying to develop a different reference point than just the ego project. And it's like also kind of connecting us into a support system, well, a resource. Prakasha uses this word resource when he's doing the guru yoga. I just really, really love it. So we're trying to put in place a capacity. To turn towards whatever is happening, a capacity to turn towards others, and a capacity to turn towards ourselves. Something that takes us beyond our limited selfhood. And I think there's just different ways of doing this. And I've been sort of shown different ways, and that's what I've been trying to sort of clarify for myself. Well, is there a particular way that I think's best, and how do they all kind of interrelate and stuff? So I think one way is to just have a much more spacious, open, simple awareness. And people have a strong, very strong devotional and heart response to the quality of open awareness, open, spacious awareness. Another way is to be in contact with a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And this has got a lot of, well, it brings in a whole quality of relationship. So I'm going to say a bit more about all this later. But it brings in a whole quality of relationship and of love and of us not being on our own in the system. And then there is this area of the heart wish. And I think what this does is puts us in contact with a deeper motivation in ourself, or a purer intention. In a way, it puts us into contact with just a deeper sense of ourself from which we can function, and we can use that to nourish ourselves. So in the 7-point mind training verses, you get maybe four lines. Let's see, you get five lines under the section called Absolute Bodhicitta. So this is sort of, I didn't want to call anything Absolute Bodhicitta, but here we go, Absolute Bodhicitta. So I'll read you a particular translation of those particular lines, and then we'll have a quick look at them, and then I'll go back to those three areas that I talked about. Just being rained down on by the bodhicitta, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Think of things as dreamlike. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Let even the antidote liberate itself. Rest in the nature of alaya, the essence. Between sessions, be a conjurer of illusions. So this is us establishing a reference point that is not going to be bogged down when we're doing the laundry or tidying up, or doing the ego project. It's loosening the ego, loosening our perspective on the ego project. So I'm going to just say a little bit about each line, not very much. Think of things as dreamlike. In other words, just see how things are just the way we perceive them. I mean, they're not, they're just dreamlike in the sense you can't really believe in them. Everything is constructed. It's all a bit mysterious, it's all quite strange, like a dream. And what does it mean? You can play around with it a bit. What does it mean to be in a dream and to really believe that something's happening and then to wake up? That's a very beautiful metaphor for how we live our life a lot of the time. Have you ever seen a dog having a dream? Yeah? You really see how dreams are real, don't you? When you see a dog having a dream. So a dog having a dream runs and makes sort of panting sound and then does something and then wakes itself up, kind of thing. I haven't had much of a relationship with dogs, but I have seen this happen once, and it's amazing. You see, that dog believes it's doing something. It's an interesting metaphor. So it's possible for us to just wake up out of the ego project, out of all the constructions, and see it was only a dream. So it just means we just sit much looser to everything. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Well, to do this requires us to just step back from all the thoughts and constructs that keep us tied to the sense of self. So again, we have to sit much looser to the sense of me, to the sense of I. Let even the antidote liberate itself. So this brings in the quality of the ungraspableness of our experience. And even the remedies, the antidote, like everything's a dream or it's all shunyata, even that becomes something that we cling on to eventually. So then we have to liberate that thought, let go of that thought. Rest in the nature of alaya, the essence. So just resting. Remain naturally relaxed. So this is just resting back in a more natural, wholesome state. Again, free from projections and concepts, constructions. Between sessions, be a conjurer of illusions. So just act with an awareness of illusion. A lot of what's happening is just being conjured up right now by me, by you. And I was thinking about, I think it's a phrase from Sangharakshita, but it might not be, where he says something like, always re-establish one's point of freedom. And I think these verses, what they're trying to do is they're trying to just free up the heavy, burdened nature that we can get into, the heavy, burdened aspect of activity. And if you like, the relative bodhicitta, like how we're trying to function in the world with love and compassion, can get very kind of dense, and we can get very dense and bogged down. And he's saying, always, always find your point of freedom again. So I've been thinking about these three areas where we can re-establish that point of freedom. So the area of open, spacious awareness, awareness of a Buddha or Bodhisattva, and the heart wish. And I'll just say a little bit more about those. So just sitting back into open, spacious awareness. It requires us just to sort of let go of tension. It's a place of ease and of openness. And that quality of spaciousness, I think, can give us a sense of proportion, like where we are in the world. It gives us the right, our right size again. You know, we can act more with a sense of choice, act more with a sense of freedom, and we can choose to act. We're not driven, we're not compulsive when we're in contact with that. When trusting in the simple qualities of awareness, so then there's the awareness of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. And maybe all of us have got a connection with one of those Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. So when we call the Buddha to mind, we can just have him in our hearts, just hold him in our hearts. And this gives us a sense of relationship, of us not being on our own, not being alone with what we've got to do. It can also give us a tremendous sense of love, our own love, our love of the Buddha, but also the love of the Buddha towards us. So we're receiving love, we're receiving support from the Buddha. And this can carry with it a strong sense of feeling resourced, of being resourced. It can also give us a sense of, again, being in the right proportion in ourself. If you're somebody who thinks too much of yourself, then the Buddha is always bigger than you. And if you're someone who tends to think too small of oneself, the Buddha can be quite a strong Kalyana Mitra and draw you out, require you to do more, encourage us to go further. I also think when we're in contact with the Buddha, we're in contact, or we can be in contact with that sense of service. So we might not always choose to do something, but in service, you don't always have that choice. You just have to serve. So in order to serve, say, Amitabha, you might act, whereas your own preference might take you a bit different, you know, take you in a slightly different direction. And that can be actually very liberating and easeful, actually. Easeful. When you're in service, you can just drop self preoccupation, which is actually a bit of a relief. And then there's this quality of the heart wish. So this is us turning more to a deeper experience in ourselves. Turning towards deeper values, maybe through words or through images. When I was thinking about it this morning, I think it gives us a tremendous sense of purity in oneself that can be a very strong resource again. It's a purity of intention or volition. I was thinking many, many years ago, when I was a very inexperienced order member, one of the women that I was working with here was just going through a very difficult time, and she was supposed to be leading a big winter retreat, and she felt unable to do that. And so a few weeks before the retreat started, I offered to lead that retreat. And then, because of who I am, while I was on the retreat, I said a dumb thing, and I got myself into trouble with the retreat, with a particular retreatant. And then the retreatant ganged up people around me a bit. So I was basically in what could be a very scary situation. And I had to kind of maintain this quality of leadership and holding the situation at times when I felt extremely vulnerable. And it played out for quite a few months. You know, the person wrote letters to Taraloka and all sorts of things. Wrote a letter to my president. All sorts of things happened from that. But I had one thing. I had a memory, which was when I'd said, I can do that retreat, that had come from a pure act of generosity. And that's what I had, even though I'd done a dumb thing after that. Do you see what I mean? And that was the thing that kind of supported me through the whole event. And it was interesting because after the retreat, I went to stay with my sister for a few days in London. She lived in Hackney, and she had a very small child at the time. And she took me to a park, and we went to a cafe in the middle of a park. I don't know where it was. And we sat down at a table, and there was a table of women next to us. And one or possibly two of those women were from the retreat. How random is that? Yeah, I mean, how likely is that, really? And I said, we said hello and everything, and then I said to my sister, I want to give her a break from looking after this three-year-old. I said, I'll go and play with Tom or Isaac or whoever it was, and you just read the paper. So I went off and played with him in the park. And when I came back, my sister said, those two women were rejoicing in you as a retreat leader from that. And she was overhearing it. And I thought, How likely is that? It's so interesting, isn't it? Anyway, so pure intention. And, well, it can see us through quite a lot of activity and darkness. There's also this lovely verse at the beginning of The History of My Going for Refuge, written by Middleton Murray. And he's talking a bit about entrusting oneself to one's secret loyalties. Yeah. And it's so gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, so do have a look at that. And turning towards our experience so that we find what those secret loyalties is, or that deeper motivation or purer intention, can sometimes be very quiet work. Sometimes that deeper level in ourselves is quite shy. So, yeah, we'll just bear that in mind. I thought I'd read you just a little paragraph from The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. So it's about, it's Sangharakshita's seminar on the White Lotus Sutra. And I was just remembering it this morning when I was thinking about this. So it's about... it's in the section on the myth of the return journey, which is such a fabulous section. And it's all about us returning back to a deeper sense of self. And at the end of it, you know, Sangharakshita is exploring, maybe the whole path is simply a path of overcoming alienation, which I might return to in a minute. So he's talking about that myth. It tells us that the higher self never loses its awareness. It's conscious all the time. Although we may completely forget the higher self never forgets us. But at the same time, this is the mystery, we are it. An image may help to make this clear. Imagine an enormous subterranean chamber all lit up within, from within. We are living in a tiny chamber next to it, indeed part of the big one. A pane of glass, which is transparent only from one side, separates the two chambers, so that although someone in the large illuminated chamber could see everything going on in the little chamber, from the little chamber we can see nothing at all of what is going on in the larger chamber. In fact, we have no idea there is a large chamber. But although cramped in our little chamber, we may forget, even be oblivious to, the existence of the larger chamber. The large chamber always has a window onto the little chamber. Even though the lower self forgets the higher self is the higher self of the lower self. So in this section on or the aspect of the heart wish, in a way we're making a return journey back to a deeper sense of oneself or a deeper motivation. Yes, which did actually when I was reading that just before I came here, I was thinking, gosh, it's quite interesting, that whole business of alienation. And it reminded me of that lovely line from Padmasambhava, where he says, again and yet again, work with whatever estranges you from meditation. And I've always loved this word, estrange, because it suggests a separation, but only temporary. You know? You become a bit estranged from something. So again and yet again, work with whatever estranges you from your heart wish, from your higher self. So all of us might have a preference to how we work with these three areas. And well, I'll lead us a little bit in going through them, all three of them. And then it'll be up to us a little bit how we play with those elements. And what we're trying to do is just sort of free ourselves up from compulsion, actually, which quite often drives our behaviour, drives our activity, drives the way that we think of ourselves. Again, in one of Sangharakshita's lines in Know Your Mind, he says, the nature of samsara is compulsion. And I use this a lot in how I think about what I'm doing. Sometimes you don't always know whether something is reactive or positive or whatever, but you know if it's compulsive. That seems to show up a bit more sort of readily. So we're just liberating our ability to engage, or our ability to turn towards experience in a way that's going to become more creative, more wholesome, more integrated, more easeful, more sustainable.